This nation was founded on the principle that all men are created equal.
We hold these truths to be self-evident.
That all men are created equal.
I'll tell you what freedom is to me. No fear. I mean, really, no fear.
Created equal.
Welcome to Created Equal from WDET in Detroit. I'm Stephen Henderson, and I'm in the studio with our producer, Carrie Jr. the second. Hey, Carrie.
Good morning.
So when you think about growing up here in the city of Detroit in the summertime, Carrie, do you think about all the things you did during the day outside with other kids in your neighborhood?
Oh, my goodness. The bike riding down the street. Well, we couldn't go like all around the neighborhood. We could only go down the street.
Right. Everyone had that boundary that their parents set. Don't go past that street light.
But yeah, right? I mean, countless days in the summertime running around, playing outside, playing in the sprinklers, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. I mean, for me, that was Detroit. That defined how I understood Detroit. You know, was how I was free in the summertime, especially once I got a little bit older, to just kind of go out and be with my friends and explore the city. Of course, that looks really different now than it used to, not just for kids in places like Detroit, but for kids all over Michigan and the nation. And it is harder to get kids access to structured play, but also just to the loose and fun play that really is important to their development. And that's what we're going to talk about today, is that lost opportunity. We've got two really good guests who have been working on trying to expand these opportunities for kids. Tell us about Tom Ferry.
Yeah, Tom Ferry, he was a sports journalist for about 30 years, with 20 years at ESPN. He's the author of a 2008 book called Game On, The All-American Race to Make Champions of Our Children. And that was like a deep investigation into the state of youth sports in America. He's also started this organization called Project Play, which includes a heavy investment in Detroit. And it's led a report called The State of Play, where they did a survey. And it was produced in conjunction with the Aspen Institute and Ralph C. Wilson Foundation and the Community Foundation for Southeast Michigan, where they really took a closer look at youth sports in this region, parents' interest in getting their kids in this region. Because even back then, we talk about organized sports being really important in our lives. Nowadays, it's kind of harder. It's more expensive. There's so much equipment. You only have access to certain kinds of sports. So it'll be really interesting to hear about what he has to say about
it. Yeah, it's really become an equality issue. And Dave Egner, who's the CEO of the Ralph C. Wilson Jr. Foundation, will also join us to talk about some of those specific youth sports opportunities and challenges that are unique to Detroit and the surrounding area. But first, let's get to Tom Ferry, who is the founder and executive director of the Aspen Institute's Sports and Society Program. His signature initiative is Project Play. Tom Ferry, it's great to have you here on Created Equal. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, so let's talk about the state of play. I love that word because it really gets to the essence of what I think children want and need, and it goes beyond sports, right? It can involve sports. Sports is a kind of central part of that concept, but the idea of play kind of takes some of the competitive or profit motive edge off of the concept, and it seems to me that makes it fit better for children. But at the same time, you know, I worry about play. I worry a lot about play as a father, as an American. You know, I don't see play in the same way happening with my children and children like them as was available for me, you know, 30 or 40 years ago.
Yeah, and you're not observing incorrectly either. Things have changed dramatically over the past 30, 40 years. I mean, when I was a kid growing up in Florida, I played organized sports, but probably the first age that I slipped on a uniform was age 8. And even after that, most of my sport experiences were unstructured play. It was making up games with my friends at the local, basketball park or, sneaking my way onto the golf course and, you know, playing a few holes before the Ranger kicked us off. It was making up, you know, football games, at the women's club where the bushes are out of bounds. I mean, this is what American childhood was for a long time. And it was super enriching, and nobody really thought of it as development necessarily, but that's what was happening to us. We were learning how to work through the playground politics. We were developing, you know, a love of our body, you know, moving, you know, healthy habits for life. It's all so foundational. We kind of took it for granted. And what's happened since then is youth sports has become highly commercialized. Some people say professionalized. I don't think it's really that, because you still have a lot of coaches who just are winging it and they're not background checked and don't really know the key competencies working with kids, as wonderful as they are. But it's just commercialized. You know, now you've got kids slipping on uniforms at 4, 5, 6 years old, and the travel teams start when they're 6, 7, mm-hmm. 8 years old. And yeah, we start structurally pushing aside the kids who can't afford the experience, and then heaping all this pressure on the kids who are at the center of the experience. And that's I think what you're observing.
So let's talk about why that's happening. And I think there are a number of different drivers, of course. But just to sort of add to what you were just talking about. So when I was a kid, I grew up in the city of Detroit, and what we had was rec centers. There were rec mm-hmm. centers all over the city, and they became kind of the central nervous system of play, right? In the summer in particular, you'd walk up to the rec center and stay all day in a structured environment that was about playing tennis, playing basketball, learning to swim, playing volleyball, doing arts and crafts. And then you'd go home at the end of the day. They also gave you lunch, free lunch, while you were there. That system meant that there was an automatic availability of that kind of play, even to kids who grew up in environments where, there wasn't money for more sophisticated play or teams or leagues or things like that. The absence of that structure seems to be one of the drivers now that makes it difficult for play. But I want to have you talk about not just that, but the other things that are interfering with people, kids, being able to find ways to explore that idea of play.
Yeah. I mean, look, sports is essentially a hardware-software equation. The hardware is the places you play, including rec centers, a local park, you know, the gym at the local high school, whether it's open or not, that type of thing. The software is the stuff you plug into that. Mm-hmm. That is, you know, the programs, the quality of those programs, the coaches, the quality of the coaches who are working with kids. And so what you had when you were younger is you had the hardware piece. And these rec centers were extremely important, not just in cities like Detroit, but also Baltimore. Mm-hmm. You know, we were bringing the Project Play Summit to Baltimore next month. And this is a city that had about 150 rec centers in the 1970s. By the end of the decade, they were down to, 40 or 50 rec centers. So think about how destabilizing that is to kids and a community. Between the hours of 3 and 6 o'clock at night, when parents are working, there was a place for kids to go. And it wasn't highly organized. It was supervised. But, you know, the kids are being watched after in some safe place. When that happens, kids are going to do something, and usually not very good, right? They'll find something else. I mean, it's, you know, when I look at the Freddie Gray riots in Baltimore and otherwise, there are definite problems with the, you know, police community relations and all that. But when you talk to people in Baltimore, they'll tell you that losing those neighborhood rec centers was just flat out destabilizing to the city. So mm-hmm. I think we need to think very hard about how to make sure every kid has a, some place to play that's within walking distance. Of where they live.
Yeah. And let's talk about the software part of that as well, how different that is today.
Yeah. So, I mean, look, there have been a couple things happened since the 1990s that have shaped, you know, that software environment. Number one is the amount of money that has been dispersed for NCAA scholarships, athletic scholarships at the Division I and the Division II level, has gone from about $250 million a year in the early 1990s to north of $3.6 billion a year now in the NCAA. And now you have NIL, right? And so what you've seen happen is greater a sense of a return on investment that parents are willing to make at an early age. Like, oh, wow, my 8-year-old's pretty good at soccer or basketball or whatever else may be. If I start writing these big checks to the clubs, then maybe they'll have a chance to get in front of scouts and get a scholarship and who knows, maybe play professional ball or otherwise. And just that mentality has really kind of taken over. And it hasn't taken over everyone, but it has certainly taken over the ecosystem. And that is what has led to the creation of these early forming travel teams that get very exclusive very early and ultimately heap a lot of pressure on a lot of kids. Yeah. And then you end up with a concussion and the burnout and the ACL injuries that are so problematic at the back end.
Yeah. And then, of course, that specialization and that focus on competitive sport at an early age, it comes with a kind of choking off, I think, of opportunity for everybody because it's so focused on who's going to play at the next level. It doesn't open the doors as wide for everybody at that beginning level. And let's talk about why that's significant. In other words, what we lose when we restrict the opportunities for that kind of play over an extended period of time for most kids.
Right. Look, I mean, the research is now like clear, flat out clear, the stacks and stacks of research. And we put it together in an infographic that lives on our Project Play website. And it shows that, you know, kids who are physically active are 1/10 as likely to be obese. They're more likely to stay in school, because sports is it's a draw for some kids. They're more likely to go to college. They're less likely to get, girls are less likely to get pregnant as teenagers. Drug use rates among athletes are lower. They're higher for athletes have higher binge drinking rates. So all the data is not necessarily good, but most of it is good. Mm-hmm. And then, then they go on to get better jobs. Typically they end up suffering, people who are physically active and play sports are much less likely to suffer a range of chronic diseases, including, I think it's 14 types of cancer, according to the NIH. Playing sports is protective against, mental health problems. Mm-hmm. I mean, on and on and on. If you were to develop a pill that delivered all of these benefits, it would be the most amazing, medical advance of all time. And it's sitting right there in front of us. So when we create sport environments, we build a sport ecosystem that says to kids and families that only those with money or kids who are extremely talented.
Yeah, extraordinary skill.
And get scholarship through or something. It's sort of cherry picking kind of. Right? When we do that, we end up hurting ourselves, not just our kids, but our society just is less healthy. And then, the public ends up picking up a lot of these medical costs later on. We have less community cohesion. I mean, kids learn how to play and play together. I mean, this is foundational to building cohesive communities and ultimately, citizens in this country that can work through problems. Yeah. So it's an issue.
Yeah. I often wondered as well, what is it about the play that develops kids better, right? There's the physical part of it that is obvious, but I feel like there's not just that. There's a mental and social aspect of this that I remember from play developing, when you're out with everybody in your neighborhood and maybe from other neighborhoods, just kind of working everything out that matters too.
Yeah. I mean, Maria Montessori, founder of the Montessori schools.
Sure.
once said that play is the work of the child. Hmm. And I think that's true. And when you're playing, what are you doing? You're problem solving. You're trying things. You're failing. You're trying something new. You know, ideally you're doing it, or often you're doing it with other people. It is, so you get social connections. You can get emotional resilience from this. It's just, I worry about kids who don't learn how to play, or we deny them opportunities to do so, because they're going to have to play the rest of their life. Yeah. If they're going to be effective and, good, if they're going to build families that are going to really, benefit. So yeah, play is seen as frivolous, but no, it's very serious work. It is how we are wired. We come out, we were born, and we are born to play. And we just, unfortunately, we have systems that, structurally get in the way of that.
They just don't support it anymore. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break here on Created Equal. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Tom Ferry. Stay where you are. We'll be right back with more Created Equal. This is Created Equal from WDET in Detroit. I'm Stephen Henderson, and I'm glad you're with us. Our guest is Tom Ferry. He's the founder and executive director of the Aspen Institute's Sports and Society Program, whose signature initiative is Project Play. He's a former sports journalist for ESPN. Tom, I want to start this segment talking about Southeast Michigan and the state of play here. In the report, you recommend something you call the 8 plays, asking kids what they want, reintroducing free play, encouraging sport sampling, revitalizing in-town leagues, and a couple others. Talk about how closely what we're doing here kind of hews to that prescription. Are we doing the right things? Are we investing in the right places?
Yeah, I think you are. Yeah, I mean, look. Again, they could have kind of come in and said, well, we're just going to write checks here to this group, to that group. But the nice thing about the Project Play framework, it's those 8 plays for the 8 sectors that touch the lives of children. And none of them are rocket science. It's ask kids what they want. It's train all coaches. It's revitalize in-town leagues. It's, encourage sports sampling. It's emphasize prevention, meaning prevention of injuries, physical and emotional, et cetera. So it becomes something of a playbook or a blueprint to begin to activate against in whatever way makes sense to stakeholders and investors in that region. And that's what the Wilson Foundation and the Community Foundation have done. Mm-hmm. All of the work is aligned with those 8 pillars, with a specific focus on the 3 or 4 that I mentioned a couple minutes ago, and that creates a coherence in an investment strategy and a way to move the region forward.
Yeah. I wonder if we can talk also about the external challenges that I think exist now to getting kids to embrace play, even where it's available. And so I'll give you an example, right? How many kids spend how many hours on computers, either doing schoolwork or, of course, socializing or playing, right? Video games are so popular and so widely available now, right? I'm always a little jealous of kids these days and the gaming experiences that they can have that look way more sophisticated than Space Invaders, which was the big game when I was a kid.
Right.
But that's competition, right? For this idea of play, or is it? I mean, is play broad enough, I guess, in the way we think of it, to kind of incorporate that kind of activity along with the physical outdoor activity that we see kind of going away?
Yeah, it's a great question. And there's not an easy, there's not a simple yes or no answer to it. Technology, screen time, diversions are absolutely a factor. Video games are a factor.
Mm-hmm.
But what I've kind of said to folks in the Project Play Network is like, don't just wring your hands at like kids spending time on these devices. Build environments that more closely match the type of experiences that they're receiving in these when they play FIFA or Madden or whatever it is, yeah. Right? So, I mean, let's think about that. I mean, when you play a video game, what is a kid doing? There's lots of action.
Mm-hmm.
There's access to the action. You start and stop a game when you want. You have no parents screaming at you when you do something wrong, right? You've got no coach who's, playing favorites. It's a social experience often, not always, often, because you're on headphones with other kids.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't have the physical activity piece of it. The physical activity piece is very important. You know, this is where you get all those benefits, disease risk reduction and so forth. So, learn from it. How do you build, little league baseball environments where there's more action than a kid standing in the right field and touching the ball three times during the game, right? How do you build an environment that is, when coaches are setting it up, it's really dialed into the needs and interests of the kid? How do you create more flexible, competition formats in practices and even in games at an early age? How do you give more control to the kids over the experience that they have? So it's not just command and control coaching stuff, at an early age. So I think people just need to learn from the screen time, mm-hmm. Diversions. And then, we now have this phenomenon of what's called esports, which is not really sports, it's gaming, where it's competition tied into it. And for a long time, I was kind of very dismissive of it. I'm like, that's not sports. And it's still not sports necessarily. But what I will say is this, is some of the literature, some of the research shows that kids who play on these esport teams and so forth, they're connected to other kids.
Yeah.
They are receiving some social and emotional, benefits from doing this stuff, as long as it's not in total excess. And in those kind of environments, so if we do have like esports high school teams, what I would encourage people to think about as they're setting them up is, all right, well, how do we stitch in some physical activity with that as well?
Right. Get out of the chair.
Get out of the chair every Saturday. Guess what? If you're going to be on this esports team, you got to show up and play soccer. Real soccer, stuff like that. So I think it's a call for some creativity.
Yeah. So I also want to talk about the competition from the standpoint of access and equity. So believe it or not, I feel like the availability of this kind of digital sporting or engagement is easier to spread more widely than access to the physical. In other words, in these urban environments like Detroit, we've got the rec centers kind of back going here, and some of them are reopened and fixed up. But boy, when you drive by, the facilities or the courts or any of the stuff around it, you don't see the level of participation. And it does seem like we aren't connecting with kids in the same way in these urban environments, and maybe even in rural environments that you would see in suburban environments like here in Detroit. I don't pass suburban basketball courts or tennis courts and see them empty. I do see that in the city still, and I wonder if some of the electronic play is interfering with that in a different way in those environments, or whether there are other factors.
Yeah, I mean, we've studied this. We've been into 14 communities around the country, for a year and a half at a time, just as we did in Detroit or Southeast Michigan and in Western New York with the with the Wilson Foundation. And some of these 14 or so have been, intensely urban, environments like mm-hmm. East Baltimore or the city of Oakland, and others have been more rural. We're going to be releasing a report soon on like Aspen to Parachute. And we looked at suburban environments. And what I can tell you is they're different. They're very different. The challenges, right? In urban areas, parents are often worried about safety. Like even there might be a park that's, five blocks away, but if they, if it's dangerous or feels dangerous for you to have your daughter go to that park and, cross through, certain neighborhoods, then parents are, it's easier for them just to keep kids on the couch. Right. In rural areas is often a transportation issue because the regional high school is so far away. So how are you going to get there? And then within that, there are certain, subpopulations that have unique factors mm-hmm. as well. Mm-hmm. Often immigrants, refugees, sure. Latinos, girls are expected to like take care of the family mm-hmm. starting at age, 12 or so. So sports is easy to kind of just push to the side or these are families that did not grow up in Title IX culture. The idea that sports are good for girls. So how do we crack that nut? I mean, it's all very, very complicated. And then you've got just the infrastructure pieces, these aging rec centers versus these sparkling new, facilities in the suburbs that are, more attractive. And, you got parents who can, that got the time to drive them to the endless array of practices and games and maybe travel tournaments, two states away. So it's just, there's a lot of factors to contend with. But the bottom line is children want to play. They want to play with other kids. Physical play is often the preferred format as long as a child feels a level of confidence, that it's not too intimidating of an environment, that they have basic physical literacy, meaning like all around athleticism, they can move their body well. And that becomes a question of like physical education. Where this stuff is often taught. So it's complicated, but I would encourage everyone to like never forget that again, children are wired to play and they are wired to move. This is what evolution has created. So don't give up on kids. Just think about how to give them the physical literacy and give them the hardware and the software that is not too far from their home.
Yeah. So I also want to talk about how much of this can be reasonably driven by policy change at the government level. I mean, one of the things that I think gets in the way of this play is the way that schools, for instance, deal with play, which is also very different than what it was in the 70s and 80s. And how much of this we have to rely on institutions like the Wilson Foundation or the Community Foundation here in Southeast Michigan to fill a gap, and whether the answer to that question says something about our values. If we really think this is important, if we really think we've got to make changes here, shouldn't government be prioritizing it and funding it? But if not, can we rely forever on philanthropy to fill that hole, right? I mean, that's not the role really even of foundations to step into places that government has stepped away from on a long-term basis.
Yeah, no, I agree. Look, I think, the role of philanthropy is to get things started, to pilot programs, to put things together that government might be more slow to do, mm-hmm. To try new things, to invest in new things and to measure them and to evaluate them. And once you've created or found or modified, effective programs that serve the needs of the community, then it's really up to government to scale it from there, right? And government does have, we really do need to have these policy conversations. We are in an environment, youth sports, it's the classic environment that is programs rich and systems poor, meaning there are all these little programs over there, but they're just not organized in a certain kind of way. And the silos aren't connected, and the stuff that is working is not scaled. But it can be done. It can absolutely can be done. I mean, we're going to be releasing some research in the coming weeks on what local government, cities and counties can do to support sports. And they're really kind of five buckets. One is just, funding and grants. They can provide funding and grants to support programs, leagues, organizations operating in their communities. I mean, this is happening in Philadelphia, Minneapolis, St. Paul. A number of cities have used the American Rescue Plan funds to begin to support youth community programs. Excise taxes can be used to support this. There's collaboration between schools and other organizations. I mean, one of the models I love is in Fairfax County, Virginia, where they've created an athletic council. It's been around for decades, and it has representatives from the eight different leading sports in the area.
Right.
And then in an at-large spot. And then there's a spot for park and recs and schools, and they come together every month and they talk through issues like, field permits and, lifting the quality of programs across the county, wherever they exist. It's just a mechanism to reconcile competing interests. That doesn't exist in most cities. Usually it's the park and recs, and people assume that they're the ones who can kind of pull everything together, but they're just so taxed.
Yeah.
And there's constant turnover. So, there are lots of things that permitting and regulation, cities and county governments have all this public land that these clubs and other entities need for their programs. You can begin to set the conditions under which you use those programs, like use those facilities and fields. Like, okay, don't just show us, that you can write a check and have insurance. Show us that your coaches have background checks and that they are trained in key competencies, or even things like, like CPR, so I think it's called the power of the permit. And municipalities without any dollars devoted can lift the quality and access. You can put access provisions in it. If you use our field, then you need to show us that, 30% of the kids in your program are from free and reduced lunch homes or something. So there's a lot that can be done.
Yeah. Okay, Tom Ferry, it was really great to have you with us on Created Equal to talk about play and youth and society. Thanks so much for joining us.
This is a great conversation. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. When we come back, we'll be joined by the CEO of the Ralph C. Wilson Jr. Foundation, Dave Eggener, to get a better picture of the state of play right here in the city of Detroit and in Southeast Michigan. We'll also take your calls. Are you a parent trying to find better opportunities for free play and activity for your kids? Are you someone who is struggling with the cost and the burden of having your kids involved in sports these days? Give us a call. Let us know how you're coping. The number is 313-577-1019. That's 313-577-1019. You can also go to Twitter and either hashtag Created Equal or at WDET. We'll be right back with more Created Equal. We're talking about young people and the access that they have to just play, especially outside in the summer, and especially with each other. We just heard from sports journalist and researcher Tom Ferry about the state of play. I want to turn to a more local focus now with Dave Eggener, who is the president and CEO of the Ralph C. Wilson Jr. Foundation, which is located right here in Detroit. Dave, welcome to Created Equal.
Good morning, Stephen. Always great to be with you.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. So Ralph C. Wilson has made more than $100 million in commitments to youth sports and recreation investments across both Southeast Michigan and, of course, Western New York in Buffalo, where you also do work. And that's since 2015. Tell me quickly, give me a thumbnail, I guess, about what that money is intended to do and what you feel like we've been able to achieve with that investment.
Great. Well, of course, let me start with who Mr. Wilson was, because mm-hmm. I think it's so important to at least explaining the split between Western New York and Southeast Michigan.
Sure, sure.
Mr. Wilson was a serial entrepreneur, successful in 11 different industries, one of them being the NFL. He owned the Buffalo Bills.
That's right.
So when he passed, the assets from his estates went to the Ralph C. Wilson Jr. Foundation, and we split our activity between those two markets, being one being his hometown of Detroit and the other being his adopted hometown of Buffalo in the Western New York region. And of course, youth sports would be important, not just because of the connection to the NFL, mm-hmm. but Mr. Wilson exercised himself well into his later years of life. And so he was active in his late 80s and really understood the importance of exercise and activity.
Yeah, yeah.
So in terms of our $100 million, Stephen, focus has been, I should just say, go back and re-listen to Tom Ferry, because that's what we've been trying to do locally. And isn't Tom amazing? It's so important, the data that Aspen has brought to this work, and they've been a critical partner to the foundation and the Project Play team that's at the Community Foundation.
Yeah, yeah. So I want to talk about what play does for the community as a whole. I mean, we were talking with Tom Ferry, and I think a lot of the focus in that conversation was on what play does for youth as individuals, right? The development that it enables and enhances and things like that. But I gathered that there is a bigger goal here, and that there's a community goal, and how having more people who have more access to play as children changes a community.
Let's start with the base data in Southeast Michigan. Mm-hmm. The Center for Disease Control says every young person should get an hour of play per day. In Southeast Michigan, 13% of the population gets an hour of play per day.
Yeah.
So this isn't just about sport. It's about far more than that. If you could just get the Southeast Michigan region to the national average, which is about 25% of the population would get to that level of play, the downstream savings in healthcare and lost productivity is over $1 billion. So this is a economic issue. Mm-hmm. It is a community issue. It's a belonging issue. It's not just a play issue. And we've got to keep that in mind. This is about far more than just kids getting out on courts and fields mm-hmm. And playing organized sports. It's far bigger than that, which is why we focused our efforts on 5 to 12-year-olds. And on building the facilities, creating the access, removing the barriers so that they can play.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, 313-577-1019 is the number here on the phones. Call and tell us how you navigate the world with your young people and trying to get them opportunities to play structured sports or just to play. Let's start with Francine in Detroit. Francine, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you very much. I really enjoyed this segment. I was a very competitive tennis player. I played Division I tennis, but one thing I wanted to talk about is that it's not always an either or, right? It's not always you play sort of rec sports and then you engage in this like very high level professional training. And mm-hmm. One thing that my experience was unique and I think was great was while I, as I developed, I did have like very high level training. I grew up on like the New York City public tennis courts with community coaches, and that actually stayed with me throughout. Mm. And it's been a really important part of like the social and emotional development of a child to have your community supporting you and this kind of community you can always go back to. So definitely shout out to the local Detroit community tennis programs like Coach Lee and Palmer Park, which I know the Ralph Wilson Foundation has supported in the past. Mm. I think they serve like a really important, foundational aspect to playing tennis and sports and kind of just, having that community support around children.
Yeah. Yeah. Francine, really appreciate the call. In that background, I also was a competitive tennis player when I was a young person, but I was nowhere near playing D1 in college. I did play in high school, but those courts at Palmer Park are a good example of the kind of access that existed when I was a kid. We had courts like that in many, many different parts of Detroit, and that's how I was able to learn to play. I could walk to a set of tennis courts near my house, and there were instructors there in the summer. The Police Athletic League had a tennis league, and there were other free participation leagues all over the city. A lot of them have gone away. Dave, talk about the role that Ralph C. Wilson is playing in kind of restoring some of that infrastructure.
Sure. I could really split that into three areas of approach. One is facilities. And as Francine said, and as you experienced, Stephen, if you don't have the facilities, you have no place to play.
Right.
And it's not just about facilities that are traditional. One of the eight plays that Aspen puts out is ask kids what they want. Mm. And when we did that in our Project Play report in 2017, one of the things that came back is they wanted more places that were created by them to play and that reach their level of competition, but also their interest. So we saw a big swing toward skate parks, which, when I was a kid, it was essentially empty swimming pools.
Right.
And so we partnered with the Tony Hawk Foundation, now called the Skate Park Project, and Kaboom, to focus on those play spaces. And so we've invested about $17 million between the two markets. Almost 100 unique play spaces will be built. There's several destination playgrounds that don't require supervision. There'll be about 20 skate parks that don't require supervision. And the thing I'm actually most excited about is there will be a number of small pocket parks and facilities that have been created by community and kids as part of that program. So in Ypsilanti, there is what was a vacant lot is now a solar lit outdoor basketball court where you can play basketball until 10 or 11 o'clock at night, depending on, what time of year it is. And one of my favorites, there is a stopwatch at a bus stop, so I can constantly see if I can beat my last 40-yard dash time.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it is about facilities first. I think equipment becomes a huge issue. Access to equipment is more difficult, so we've made investments in a number of things. A lot of them in the playing field is a new organization online. We've just got them in Western New York. We're having talks about Southeast Michigan, getting more sports equipment in. An organization called Good Sports, we've invested more than $500,000 in to get equipment out. We've worked with the YMCA to build a mobile sports court program that has equipment. And then access. That's the toughest one, Stephen, as you and Tom were talking about. It's how do you get kids off the couch? How do you help folks that don't feel safe with their kids out? How do you increase the rec league opportunities? Those are the hardest things to deal with, but those are the three breakdowns, really: facilities, equipment, and access.
Yeah.
That we're working on.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, really appreciate the call, Francine, and the perspective there. Let's go to Calissa in Detroit. Calissa, what's on your mind?
Hi, thank you for having me.
Sure.
I was really interested in
what you guys mentioned about access and also, I'm sorry, about when there are community spaces, making sure that the instructors have background checks and CPR mm-hmm. training. That, from my experience working in the nonprofit field, that is like majorly missing in a lot of programs. So I think that's huge. Also, my kids do go to Detroit Waldorf, and I feel like education on a Waldorf-type philosophy would be a really simple way to, if people were more interested and more knowledgeable about the Waldorf method, that it would be an interesting way to get people.
So Calissa, can you quickly explain to our listeners what that is and how that would inspire more interest in active play?
Well, because the Waldorf method, it's natural play spaces, so nature mm-hmm. and also imaginative play. So basically, you don't really need much.
Yeah.
You know, so if more people accepted that type of philosophy in young childhood, early childhood, and beyond, it would be a really simple way to get Southeast Michigan kids out and about. And it's just kind of almost a culture shift, because it doesn't cost anything to have natural materials and imaginative play.
Right. Calissa, I love that you called and made that point, Dave Agner, that question of, again, access and making sure things mm-hmm. are available is so critical still in our community because of the deep poverty. Are we making a dent in moving toward more access for more people who wouldn't otherwise be able to afford it, I guess?
I think we are making a dent, Stephen. I think that the challenge is going to be, it's a long-term game here.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The greatest hope I have right now in the city of Detroit is the Joe Louis Greenway.
Yes, yes.
It will not only provide trailheads that will have points of recreation and gathering. The Warren Trailhead that they just opened has the most beautiful play space I've seen in the city. It has a center outside, restrooms and a gathering facility, an outdoor fireplace, and it connects to what will be a 27-mile greenway mm-hmm. that will connect neighborhoods. And you know, when I was a kid, I jumped on a bike and I rode 7.5 to 8 miles to the basketball court. if you wanted to play, it was where you went to play if you wanted to be a player. And today, that's tough.
Yeah.
But imagine what that 27-mile greenway will do to connect neighborhoods and facilities, et cetera. So there are pieces in development. There have been some progress, but we've got to think about the location of play spaces in neighborhoods, the safety of those play spaces. And to Calissa's point as well, how do we assure that all the coaches are trained, the volunteers are in place? So that we can monitor those things.
Yeah. That the greenway, the planning for the greenway, and the planning connecting to this idea of access for people in the city is something that I feel like is still really taking shape. But I'm hopeful that in a few years, when it really gets going, that all of that comes together in a way that brings people to the greenway and makes the greenway a way to get around to other places. That is going to be really key with youth play.
Right. Hey, Stephen, one other thing Calissa sparked in me is if you want to get involved and you want to be a part of the movement of getting kids involved in sports, go to projectplaysemi.org. Projectplaysemi.org. That is the Community Foundation program that we've helped support, that has a table set of people who are experts in the field of sport, and mm-hmm. they are working to attack these issues, and they are always looking for people to volunteer, to engage. There's a place to sign up, get a newsletter. But Calissa, if you want to be part of this and be one of those tennis instructors that could be out there, this is a place to do it.
Yeah. Okay, Dave Agner, president and CEO of the Ralph C. Wilson Jr. Foundation. Really great to have you here with us on Created Equal. Thanks so much for joining today.
Thanks, Stephen.
That is going to do it for us on Created Equal. Created Equal is produced by Carrie Jr. II and David Lines. Our audio is by Connor Anderson, and our engineer is Nate Bender. The music is by Sam Bobian. Created Equal is a production of WDET, a listener-supported service of Wayne State University. This is 101.9 WDET-FM, Detroit's public radio, your connection to news, music, and conversation.